Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary
with Professor Jennifer Curtin. Morena, Jennifer, how are you?
Morena, Rachel, I'm good, thank you.
Pleased to be back at level two?
Yes, although, you know, the university's telling us we should all still work from home. So we have summer scholars who are finishing off and we can't take them out and celebrate until for a couple more weeks yet, really.
It's a tricky one, isn't it, when you've got a big amount of people to organise as well. How do you think, I guess we've talked a lot over this last year about how the government's been handling this pandemic, and one of the things that is always commented on is the way that the communication of what's going on has been rolling out. And, you know, sometimes they've got it right and sometimes they've got it not so right. What are your thoughts around how this particular little outbreak has been handled in terms of communication with the public and transparency?
Well, I mean, I have to say that I don't know about the transparency. To me, it looks like when we hear that there are community cases, there's, you know, we have to also learn to live with the virus. So once we know that there are community transmission in Auckland, perhaps we also need to be prepared for an announcement that it's quite possible mm-hmm. we will change alert levels because we've been here before. So on Sunday, for example, I had to buy new walking shoes because I broke my leg last year, and I went and got them on Sunday because I was nervous that maybe we would have to go into alert level 3 and it would complicate things.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose the other thing is that we as citizens are starting to get used to the idea that we will get announcements. I think the journalists do a really good job of revealing whether or not the government is doing enough on the transparency side. So I suppose where my sense of trust lies is actually that the journalists are going to be mm-hmm. prompting accountability from the government on whether they are being sufficiently transparent about how many tests they're doing, when they know what's going to happen, and we have to trust the Fourth Estate to do that for us.
Absolutely. That is the role of the Fourth Estate. And I think that's maybe something as well we've seen in the last year, particularly with people watching the full press conferences and kind of getting to look behind at the thing that you don't normally necessarily see. It's copped a lot of flack, sometimes valid criticisms, and sometimes maybe a little bit harsh or a little bit unnecessary. So it's been an interesting year for, I guess, the whole country learning how these things work. Something that that has come up in this last lockdown is the idea about our wage subsidy schemes, and that's been something that's been very significant for tiding people over in 2020. There was quite a lot of criticism over the fact that it's a 3-day lockdown can be very significant for people who are sole traders or who cannot work in any sort of way under level 3, and a lot of people have been calling for some sort of immediate relief package or something that helps people from the moment that an announcement that we might be changing into one of those higher alert levels happens. What are your thoughts around this, and do you think the government's doing enough? Do you think that those supports are in place? What's your opinion on that, Jennifer?
Well, they passed legislation under urgency on Tuesday night, and that was fully supported by the opposition parties. But rather than calling it a wage subsidy, it's more like a business support package, if you like. And what it does is changes the system that we had before of 14 days of loss of revenue is now 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be used for anything, to support workers who have to work from home, support traders and so on. Still, the idea is based on how many employees they have, but with a one-off fee. I think the idea here is so that businesses don't actually have to use it for wages. They can use it mm-hmm. for whatever else they want. And even if we're at 3 days at alert level 3 in Auckland, because we're staying at alert level 2 until Monday, this makes it a 7-day change of alert to enable businesses to apply for this. So they've made it more flexible, perhaps a broader coverage and less red tape for businesses, but also for the bureaucrats who are managing it. Whether or not it's actually going to go to the people that also need it beyond traditional understandings of business and getting to the people who need to cover their bills and still buy supplies and so on, I'm not really sure. You know, ideally we'd want to see benefit levels go up and other support payments in other parts of the system be managed with the same flexibility.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some non-COVID related stuff, but a big topic that's come up in the last 48 hours is this woman who's been detained on the border trying to enter Turkey. And now she had an Interpol blue alert. Can you explain what that is, first of all? What does that mean? And why was she sort of picked up in the first place?
Right, so this is not something I can talk about. This is an international relations sort of scholar take. My understanding is the blue element is, it may not mean that she's actually been involved in terrorist activities, but that she's wanted for some kind of issue related to a crime. So, I think the main thing here is that because she held dual citizenship,
mm-hmm.
and really the stoush has been around the fact that Australia moved very quickly to renounce her or strip her of her citizenship, Australian citizenship, even though she had lived in Australia since she was six and her children were born there, and New Zealand was left, some people have called it, they were snookered, that's what one media outlet called it, because now the response is, you know, Turkey contacted New Zealand and said, you know, you need to look after this woman and, you know, come sort this out. And the Australians, you know, washed their hands of it because they have this law that they amended in 2015 that allows the Minister of Immigration or Homeland Security to renounce the citizenship of one of their people if they have dual citizenship, and there's nothing in that law that I can see that requires them to have a conversation with the second country that the dual citizenship relates to.
Now, the Prime Minister's been extremely forceful in her wording around this and her frustration on the issue, particularly when she addressed the press the day before yesterday, was very palpable. Is this precedented for the way that this particular government and Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has interacted with Scott Morrison's government in Australia in the past, or is this something that we've not necessarily seen before?
So Ardern has, I think, raised the level of rhetoric in challenging the Prime Minister of Australia on some of these, what we might think of as human rights, citizenship type issues. She's done it over deportations, and we know that it's a challenging relationship sometimes. So when some of But the thing is this is a domestic issue for Australians. So on the day that it was really big news here, it didn't hit the news at all in some of the major media outlets in Australia. And this is exactly how it rolls. And so I'm kind of surprised that some in the media say this has taken the relationship to a new low. Actually, our relationship with Australia has these kinds of ebbs and flows all the time.
Mm.
I mean, Australia knew about the terrorists who were going to bomb the Rainbow Warrior before they did and didn't tell New Zealand. Paul Keating, when he was Prime Minister, you know, started changing rules for New Zealanders' access to unemployment benefits and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1993. This is the nature of the Australian-New Zealand relationship. I think what's different this time is Ardern has, over the last couple of years, tried to call Morrison out on it in a much more public way. And you could argue that for domestic consumption here, to show that she is being a strong leader in trying to represent her citizens' interests in Australia.
Now, just briefly, before we let you go, Jennifer, we should touch base on something else that's happening in Australia at the moment, and that is allegations that have come out from a parliamentary staffer in Australia who alleges that she was raped in Parliament by another colleague who has been dismissed. So this is a big thing that's been happening over there, and it's pointed to much broader questions about the culture. The culture in Parliament in Australia, and also how it's being handled by Scott Morrison's government. What is your, I guess, immediate takeaway from this?
Well, first I would say that this is what blew up on the same day that Ardern was stripping down Morrison. So it's really not surprising that we didn't see a lot of coverage of the New Zealand politics because Morrison had to handle this. And the young woman who's made the allegation went on television. So the entirety of Australia knows about this poor woman's experience, but also the handling of it. And I think what it shows, you know, in New Zealand's Francis report showed something very similar, that there is a really pervasive culture of bullying and harassment that happens in Parliament. And the way in which, even though parties have introduced codes of conduct there, and Morrison is going to do a review of Parliament, these reviews happen all the time. But the change of practice requires a change in the legislation that governs members of Parliament. And there's a real dragging of heels on that, because they're not accountable at the moment. There's no one that holds their behaviour and their staffers' behaviour to account. The members of Parliament are the employers of the staffers, who are sometimes the perpetrators of the supporting behaviour. And there's sort of, at the moment, no checks on how to rectify this. And it's a broader culture within Morrison's party as well as through the Parliament. So there's a lot of work that has to happen in this space for women to be able to feel safe at work in Parliament.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Professor Jennifer Curtin. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Rachel.
Ka kite.
You just heard a bit of political commentary. With